Okay, we're going to look at the seventh chapter of St. John and pull these two stories in it together and see what we can make of it. And verse 1 starts out saying, after this, Jesus remained in Galilee. He would not go to Judea because the rulers of the people wanted to have him killed. Now, the word rulers translates from the Greek word archon. And archons are very significant in Gnostic metaphysics. They refer to, it means rulers, but it refers to those psychological rulers that govern us while we are trapped in the mortal condition, unless we rise above it. So, sort of the angels of the demiurge. Now, the demiurge, which means the mini creator, is our mortal minds projected out and creating the world in which we live, because every one of us lives in a world created by his or her own mortal mind. And there are various stimuli that we respond to in that creation, but we don't all see them the same, and we definitely don't all perceive the things that are this physical the same. And we live in a world of our own creating. And so the Gnostics acknowledge this by speaking of the demiurge, the little creator, which is actually ourselves, projected out onto the divine. And the archons are the emotions and tools used by our minds to keep us subjected to this illusion, this creation that we've made. And throughout this chapter of John, we keep hearing of the rulers of the people. And of course, we think of the rulers of the people there in Jerusalem, which is okay as far as the myth is concerned. But in every case, in reality, if we said the archons of the people, meaning those who rule the people because of their mortal condition, we'd be getting closer to what's being said here, to what the author is really talking about. And I think you'll see that as you watch. So listen to this word ruler. You keep hearing it, and at least do a double on it. Realize that it's talking about metaphysical rulers as well as specifically. And if you want it to be physical ones too, that's fine. Verse 2 says that all this is taking place during the Feast of Tabernacles, and that's an important key. Now remember that in the last chapter he used exactly the same wording about the feast the Feast of the Passover. And we talked about how the Feast of the Passover has certain metaphysical meanings, which if you put them into the chapter, help you to understand what the chapter was focusing on. And this is no exception to that. When he tells us it's the Feast of the Tabernacles, and he's using exactly the same words as before, he's putting in a key to make our minds think of certain things. So we have to think about tabernacles and realize that just as chapter 6 gave a mythic base for the sacrament, which is not discussed in the Testament of St. John in the ways that it is in the Synoptic Gospels in terms of the Last Supper, here we're going to get a radically different mythic base for the Transfiguration. The Transfiguration is a story found in the other three books in the Bible, but not in John, of Jesus taking three of his disciples up onto a mountain, and they see him transformed. They see him not as a mortal, but as a being of light. And they see two other beings of light coming and talking to him. And then afterwards, according to one of the writers, only Luke, says that Peter said, we should build tabernacles, which means like arbors, roofs, three of them to commemorate this event. And then Luke says, Peter didn't know what he was talking about, he just didn't know what to say, so he said this. But really, it's Luke who didn't know what was going on. Because Peter understood a connection to tabernacles, that the Feast of Tabernacles is about transformation. That in these feasts, we go through a progression from Passover, which is redemption, through Pentecost, as it's commonly called, or the Feast of Sophia, or the Feast of the Holy Spirit, as we usually call it, which is about receiving that divine within us and being individuated so that we become whole, to tabernacles, which is transfiguration, which is rising above the mortal condition and living in the divine condition. So, when John says that this takes place in the Feast of Tabernacles, he wants us to be aware of all that. That we're talking here about transfiguration, if you will, about rising above the mortal condition, about being changed, about being transformed. He's giving us a great key with that one little line. And if we keep that in mind, it helps us to have a better idea of what's going on as we go through the chapter. Well, Jesus' brothers try to goad him into going to Jerusalem for the feast, but he declines. He says to them, the time for me to go to Jerusalem has not yet arrived, but the time for doubters to scoff is always here, because they were trying to get at him by saying, well, if you're really a prophet, which he hadn't exactly said he was anyway, but if you're really a prophet, go up to Jerusalem and show it, demonstrate. He says, you know, it's not time for me to do what I need to do in Jerusalem, but any time is time for guys like you who just ridicule others, push others, try to manipulate others instead of getting on with your own lives. And so he's saying something very significant here, which is, I am conscious of propriety. Now, propriety is a principle that underlies all others, and it is that there's an appropriate time for doing anything, and other times when it ought not to be done. We don't have an absolute list of things that we should do and that we shouldn't do. That's a very orthodox concept. It's not a Gnostic one. Rather, we realize that the thing that would be appropriate at one time is not appropriate at another time because of the circumstances and the changes. And we have to be sensitive to that if we're going to determine the right thing to do. No one can give us a list of things we shouldn't do. All we can do is have our awarenesses heightened so that we can perceive if the timing is right or wrong for doing a thing. Now, some things we might never come upon the right time to do, but we can't be sure we won't. Even really extreme things, in really extreme circumstances, we might do appropriately. Ordinarily, we don't face those decisions, but we still face the question of, if I do this, what will be the consequences, and is it appropriate to do it in light of those consequences, both to myself and to others? We have to weigh this out in making our decisions of what we do. And Jesus is essentially saying that here. I have to pick my times because I'm sensitive to propriety. It doesn't matter to you because you're not, anyway. Later, however, Jesus went up to the feast by himself. Same feast that he said that it wasn't time to go to. Now, there's no indication in the book, in the text that we have, whether this was his plan all along, he just didn't want to go with them, or whether something happened to change his mind. But we do know that he went secretly to observe. So perhaps he just wanted to go inconspicuously and not with the crowd, who obviously were going to be trying to bring attention to him anyway, not because they wanted to support him, but because they wanted to put him down. It says he wanted to observe things in Jerusalem, although we'll find out that isn't exactly what happened. Because about the middle of the feast, Jesus went into the temple and began to teach. The people were amazed when they heard the confidence with which he taught. Who is this ignorant man who presumes to teach as though he were a learned rabbi, some asked. Now, it's not that Jesus was really ignorant in the sense we would use the word, but he wasn't highly trained in rabbinical methods of exegesis. He didn't teach the way the rabbis did. He had his own methods. And therefore, they were saying, well, what business is he of teaching? He hasn't been trained to teach. Right? But Jesus replied, the doctrine I teach is not my own. I have learned it from those who sent me. Jesus' teaching wasn't made up. It didn't come from the rabbis or anyone else on the mortal plane. Because when he said those who sent me, he meant the divine that sent him. He was representing divine reality. Anyone, he continued, who lives by these principles I teach will soon know whether I have created my own doctrine or have received it from the Elohim. So he made a claim. The divine has sent me and I teach what they have given me. But he did then say, and you better believe this. He said, and if you'll try it out, you'll know for yourself whether this is true or not. Does that sound like a very Gnostic saying? Mm-hmm. You will know through experiencing it, right? That's the Gnostic saying, isn't it? So he's throwing it right out there from there. Don't accept what I say because I say it. Don't accept it because of my training. Don't accept it because I've got the right rabbi's names on my certificate. try it out and see. If it's valid, you'll know. If it isn't valid, you'll know. And then he concludes, you should not evaluate things according to your traditions, but according to spiritual principles. That is, not from what others have said, handed down to you, can you know whether something is right or wrong. And of course, we know lots of people like that. They are, and you pick on anybody, I hear this a lot from the source of Catholics, they are Catholic because their parents were Catholic. They don't go to church, they don't really leave that much in it, but they are Catholic because their parents are Catholic. And I hear this from others. Certain other traditions are really strong in that. But it's Jesus is saying that's not a good basis. You have to know on the basis of testing things metaphysically. See what the results are. Then you can't be good at that. Well, Jesus was hitting a chord in some people, and they were wondering if he could be the Messiah. The Messiah was the one they were looking for. Now, originally the idea of Messiah was someone to govern because of having become united with the divine. But of course, govern whom? The only one you can really govern is yourself. So it had to do with our development into the divine image. We become Messiah by growth and gnosis. But it had become in people's minds the idea of a political liberator, and that's what they had in mind. Most of them, when they said Jesus could be the Messiah. But many said this was impossible because he didn't meet their pretense, and they're arguing about it. Well, he is the Messiah in that he is the mythic figure of our divine potential, which is Messiahship. But he wasn't the political ruler they were looking for. Verse 28 says that then Jesus stopped his teaching. You think you know who I am, he shouted. You think you know where I came from and who my parents are, but you don't know my true origin, nor do you know the parents who sent me, for they are the embodiment of truth. So the argument was, could this be the Messiah? Well, we know where he came from, we know his hometown, we know his parents, we know his family. Couldn't be the Messiah, but he's saying, you don't know anything about that. And he could have said it about anyone who has been awakened to reality. Because we don't really come, that is, we don't really originate in our hometown. We don't really originate from our physical parents. We are more than all of this. So when he says, you don't really know where I come from, he was speaking for everyone who's been enlightened enough to know who they really are and what they really are. You can't know them, my true divine parents, my true source, because you're devoted to falsehood and delusion. But I know them, for I've come from among them. They sent me to the mortal plane specifically to manifest their light in this world of darkness. Now I repeat, he says, I know them because I came from among them. He wasn't saying that he is unique in this. He was saying, when you wake up, you will know that you came from among them, and you will know them. But you can't know them as long as you think that your origin was being born of physical parents on this physical plane in some particular location here, and that's where you're from and who you are. That's an illusion. Now get back to what your real source is and find out who you really are. The rulers, that word, sent guards to arrest Jesus. But he told the people not to worry because he wasn't leaving them yet. So the archons of mortal existence, these emotions, these things that well up from our psyche, our egos, are trying to wrap Jesus, the archetype of wholeness, around and keep him from operating in us. But he says, don't worry about it. There's no power over me. I'm not ready to leave. Now, in us, that would mean he's not ready to leave unless we're ready to go now. So we don't have to worry about that. That battle's going to go on in everybody. But we don't have to worry about the outcome as long as we have decided that we don't want to open up to that wholeness, which is that potential. But, Jesus said, then you will look for me, but you won't be able to find me, nor will you be able to come where I'm going. He said this because most of them were physically minded. They couldn't find him because he was moving into a greater reality, a higher plane of existence. And they couldn't rise above their physical mindedness to perceive where he was going and what he was. So they couldn't do the transformation themselves. They couldn't go there themselves. Now, he wasn't speaking to those who were open to that. The crowd represents those who weren't. So then they begin speculating about where he might go. And the author comments, they didn't understand that Jesus said this because they wouldn't look beyond the physical plane. So I'm not telling them anything that I know up there. They followed him because of the miracles he performed, not because of the truths which he illuminated. And we keep getting that in John. Jesus did things that appeared miraculous to people, but there's a negative spin put on the idea that that's any basis for following them. Because that's seeing physical numbers. That's not seeing the reality he was representing. That's the first of the two stories. Now the second story is set on the great day of the feast. Now, the Tabernacles, just like Passover, lasts 7 days. But in this case, they added an eighth day, the great day of the feast. Now, we said that the 7 days represented the principle of transformation, of rising above our mortal limitations. So this eighth day, the great day of the feast, represents being above them, being able to rejoice and being freed from mortal constraint. That's the background to the second story. And it says that on that day, Jesus stood up and shouted, "If any of you are thirsty, come to me and drink. If you believe in me, the scripture will be fulfilled in you, which says, from his stomach will flow rivers of living water." He was referring to the Spirit, which those who believed in him would receive. For those who believed in him had been promised that they would receive the Holy Spirit after he had descended to the Elohim. So he's saying the great day of the feast, the end of this transforming process that we're undergoing, you know, is to be merged with our divine reality, our inner light, our spiritual self, our contrasexual self, all of those parts of us that are repressed, is to experience the fullness of that. And that's what the great day of the feast is referring to. So when we have tabernacles, we're looking for 7 days of transforming, and then that eighth day, and what it means to be whole and transformed and divine, which is our potential. And then, so verse 53 says, then the people dispersed in confusion. That is, they couldn't make anything of what Jesus was saying. John is telling us all through his book that most people never did make any sense out of what Jesus was saying. There are three other books in the New Testament, the New Covenant, to tell us a perspective of Jesus' teachings that people could get out of them, but John's saying that's not what he was teaching. It's good, it's valid, we may draw on it, but the real thing he was teaching is here, and it's only understandable if we stop looking at everything physically and see what we really are and what our potential really is, and then it begins to make sense. So the rest of the chapter really is just a playing out of that theme, that those who oppose Gnosis end up in confusion because they end up trapped in the mortal condition, and it is confusion. Confusion is the natural state of mortals. All you have to do is look around and know that. Read the newspaper, look at the TV, or look at your next door neighbors, or maybe the person in the next room. Don't bring any closer to home than that. But we know that the mortal condition is full of confusion. The Gnostic mindset is to rise above that confusion, live above that confusion, and have harmony, have peace, have power, the power to govern our lives so that the confusions are continually with us around. That's the basic message of John 7. And with that in our mind, we're ready to go on. Next time we will look at chapter 8 and see what new life that brings on to transformation, because we're noticing that John starts out by suggesting that the divine word descends and becomes mortal. And then the whole book is telling us that means to us that we can ascend and become immortal, become more than mortal, become divine. Mm-hmm.